and welcome to the Europeans podcast, your weekly bowl of digestible European news.
That is disgusting. No one's going to want to listen to this podcast after saying that.
There's nothing disgusting about a bowl of news.
People will see in a second why you've described us that way. But hello, Dominic from Paris. You're very far away again.
Yeah, come back, Katie.
I'm back in Paris. But it was really nice, Dominic, to see you last week in person. We actually got to hang out IRL. It was a very rare treat.
It was very nice. Thank you for coming all the way to Amsterdam. I'm sorry I still haven't been to Paris in like 6 years.
Not really excusable. No, it was very nice indeed. My baby spent most of the time we were together trying to eat Dominic's hat, which was fun. But it was very nice to see you and producer Kat and a bunch of our listeners. We had a little meetup for supporters of the show, and it was really, really nice to be able to put so many faces to names.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I went away from it feeling like I didn't actually thank them enough in person for supporting the podcast. I was just like so overwhelmed to see them all in real life. So thank you all. And thank you everyone who wasn't there for supporting this show. We wouldn't be here without you.
But we're back now to being in different countries, zooming out to look at what's been going on across Europe. Normal service has resumed. What are we talking about this week?
This week, we're going to be speaking about a topic I've been lobbying to discuss for many months now, Nutri-Score food labelling. I think probably nobody is going to be as excited as I am about this, but trust me, it's very interesting. Nutri-Score, for those of you who don't live in a country that has it yet, is a food labelling system from A to E that ranks the nutritional value of your food. In some countries in the EU, this system has now been adopted by national governments. So lots of food you buy has this A to E ranking. And the reason why I wanted to talk about it is because I've been quite confused by it. I spotted some very weird Nutri-Scores in the supermarket. For example, I saw a sugar-free cola with an A rating and a box of chamomile tea bags with a C rating. What is going on? I wanted to find out, so we are going to be speaking to a nutritional labelling expert, Ali de Boer, later on in the show to work out what's up with Nutri-Score.
But first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good Week, Bad Week.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
Yeah, it's a very bittersweet one this week, but I'm going to say it's been a good week for people power and fighting back when you see your country going in a dangerous direction. I'm going to give my good week to the protesters who've been taking to the streets in Georgia. You've probably seen pictures in the news of these massive crowds in Tbilisi, a lot of them waving EU flags. That's been going on for a few weeks now, but the crowds have really grown over the past week, and they've been facing an increasingly violent police crackdown. So I really wanted to talk about it this week.
I like how this format sometimes forces us to like take a positive spin on a news story that seems quite depressing on the surface of it. Could you start by giving me the basics? I haven't been following it too closely. What are these protests actually about?
Yeah, so the protesters are angry about plans to bring in a new law in Georgia. And on the surface, it sounds like a pretty bland law if you don't know any of the context. It would mean that media outlets and NGOs need to be listed on a register if they get more than 20% of their funding from foreign countries. That register, though, would define these NGOs and media outlets as, quote, pursuing the interests of a foreign power, which makes it sound like all of the organizations that receive some of their funding from abroad are automatically doing something suspicious, right?
Yeah.
And that really matters because a really large proportion of Georgian civil society is dependent on Western funding. And that includes independent media and rights organizations that just happen to be critical of the ruling party, Georgian Dream. It might still not be immediately obvious as to why being on a register definitely poses a serious problem. Like, after all, the law isn't saying that organizations that receive that foreign funding would be banned or anything. And we have debates all the time in the West about the need to limit the influence of foreign governments in our media and in our business. And indeed, Georgia's government itself is saying that it's doing something that plenty of Western governments have done already. But if you look at Georgia's next door neighbor, Russia, it then becomes really obvious why thousands of people are taking to the streets over this. Because Russia introduced a law that looked extremely similar to this back in 2012. And very quickly, that law became a weapon for shutting down groups that were critical of the Kremlin, whether that's the media or NGOs. It was something that really helped Putin to turn Russia into the authoritarian nightmare that it is today. So the big fear is that something really similar to this could happen in Georgia if this law gets passed.
This isn't the first time the Georgian government have tried to pass something like this, is it? Like, weren't there protests over something exactly like this before, or am I misremembering?
No, you're remembering correctly. So this law that they're trying to pass right now, it's almost identical to one that the government tried to push through last year. And that time, they backed down after people took to the streets over it. What we're seeing now is a repeat of that, except that this time, the government looks more determined to push it through. And there's been a lot of speculation over why that is and whether it's essentially because the Kremlin has asked them to. Georgian Dream, the ruling party, they deny that they're a servant of the Kremlin, but they do have a rather unclear relationship with Russia. Officially, the two countries have no diplomatic relations at all, and that's been the case since Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. But Georgia has had quite an ambiguous position on Ukraine. And the ruling party's founder, who's this oligarch called Bijina Ivanishvili, he's increasingly talking in this like Putin-esque kind of way, like very conspiratorial and anti-Western. So yeah, a lot of people think that Georgian Dream is trying to push this law through now because it wants to steer the country on a much more pro-Russian trajectory. And that does seem to probably be the case, but it's still not 100% clear.
But this is also a government that's been trying to pursue EU membership, right?
Right, yeah. Officially, yes. It is literally written into the constitution that Georgia wants to be closer to the EU. And that is something that moved a big step closer in December when Georgia was officially granted EU candidate status. Of course, that process could take years and years, but it's still a big deal that they're officially a candidate. But if this law gets passed, this is something that would seriously jeopardize that bid for EU membership. A law that could strangle basically all criticism and activism against the government. It doesn't exactly line up with EU values. And a bunch of high-ranking EU officials have said that publicly in recent days. It's actually really tricky trying to figure out what Georgian Dream are up to. They've been in power for 12 years now, and officially they've been pro-EU throughout that time. But they've also, to some extent, been repairing relations with Russia. But in terms of what the population want to see for their country, people in Georgia overwhelmingly think that the future of the country should lie with the EU. If you look at surveys, about 80% of the population think a closer relationship with the EU would be good for Georgia. And you can really see that in these street protests. You can see loads of people holding EU flags alongside Georgian ones. People have been playing the EU anthem, Ode to Joy. I have to say I found it quite moving watching this from within the EU. The other thing that I found quite moving is just how organised and how brave the protesters are. They're mostly pretty young, and they've really set up a very well-organised protest movement in terms of using social media to spread information about the police crackdown, helping people from outside Tbilisi to find accommodation. And they're doing all of this in the face of tear gas and water cannons and pepper spray and increasingly high chances of arrest. There have been more than 60 protesters arrested at the time of recording. And that's why I think they deserve good week, even though there's a very real chance of them losing this fight.
How likely is it that this law will actually pass?
Well, it's not over yet. The law needs to pass 3 votes in Parliament, and it's passed 2 of them. It was actually the second one of those votes last week that caused loads more people to take to the streets because this suddenly felt like an increasingly likely possibility. In theory, the president, Salome Zurabishvili, she could refuse to sign this law. She's a big critic of it. But the ruling party actually have a big enough majority in parliament to override her. So if the government don't back down, this very dangerous bill is expected to be law by June. And it really feels like the country's at a massive crossroads. Like, if it passes, Georgia is really headed down the route of Russia-style authoritarianism, with basically no criticism allowed of the people in power. But if the protesters win and the government gives up, the country heads in a more pro-European direction. It really is a huge deal, and we'll have a better idea at the end of this month which way things are headed.
We'll be watching closely.
Who's had a bad week?
I'm giving bad week to democracy in Germany after the politician Matthias Ecker was attacked by 4 teenagers and seriously injured, ending up in hospital. The attack happened last Friday whilst Ecker was out campaigning for re-election as a member of the European Parliament for the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, in Dresden, which is the capital city of the state of Saxony in the east of Germany, if your geography is not very good, which mine isn't.
And how's he doing, Matthias Ecker? Is he recovering okay?
Apparently he's doing well under the circumstances, but his cheekbone and eye socket were both fractured, meaning that he required an operation. He was attacked by four young males aged 17 and 18, teenagers. One of the suspects turned himself in on Sunday, accompanied by his mother, and it's being reported that they have since identified the other three attackers and searched their homes for evidence.
And my kind of instant thought when I saw the headlines about this was that if a Social Democrat candidate has been attacked, this is presumably an attack by the far right, you would assume or maybe suspect. But was this definitely a politically motivated attack?
It wasn't clear until actually just this morning I checked. And now there is confirmation that the police have assigned one of the four teenagers to this category of politically motivated right wing. We know a witness of the crime identified them as right wing immediately. And it's also important to mention that the four teenagers also attacked a Green Party campaigner on the same day who was putting up posters in the neighbourhood.
I mean, it's quite alarming that something that we've been seeing a lot more in the run-up to the European elections this time than last time 5 years ago is like young people going against this image that we have of them as being generally left-leaning and more of them voting for the far right. We're seeing this in quite a few countries other than Germany, no?
Yeah, I also find it really alarming. If we look, for example, at the Bavarian state elections in 2023 as an example, the AfD, the far-right party, received 18% of the vote amongst Germans aged 18 to 24. This was up 9% on the previous election and higher than the overall vote of all Bavarians for the AfD. So the youth were actually pulling the results towards the far-right, something that I think would have been unimaginable when you and I were that age, Katie, which is not so long ago.
Thank you for the reminder.
And the youth vote will actually be bigger in the European elections this year because 16 and 17-year-olds are allowed to vote in the European elections in Germany for the first time. Also the case in Belgium, Austria, Greece and Malta, although not across the entire bloc.
I mean, when I look at my own country, France, and I look at like how the far right communicates here, Jordan Bardella, who's the lead candidate here for the far-right Rassemblement National, he's kind of widely seen as the heir in waiting to Marine Le Pen. He's really good at TikTok. And that's true in Germany as well, right? Like I read that AfD content on TikTok is getting like a ton more views than, you know, content posted by the Social Democrats. And I can't help but think that, you know, mainstream parties need to get better at talking to young people on the platforms where young people actually hang out if they want to win their votes.
Yeah, it's a big story that the far right are doing so well on TikTok and specifically so well at targeting young people. To some extent, I think it's not fair to blame these mainstream parties for not being good enough at it because as far as I understand it, the algorithms are designed in a way that promotes shocking and often simplified ideas. Mm. And the far right are full of those. The AfD's lead candidate in the European elections is a man called Maximilian Krah. And he was incredibly popular on TikTok with a rather strange mix of dating advice for men mixed with far-right conspiracy theories.
Great combo.
Those conspiracy theories eventually persuaded TikTok to step in, and they've actually limited his account in the algorithm. So his content is no longer recommended by the app, and some of his videos have been taken down. That's something, but yeah, is it going to be enough? I doubt it. And yeah, there's a growing amount of research showing that radical right-wing populist ideologies are more likely to lead to a justification of political violence. I'll link to one from last month in the show notes. As for last week's violence against Ecke in Dresden, many politicians are pointing their finger directly at the AfD for creating a climate in which political violence is so rife. Mm. The co-chair of the SPD said at a rally this weekend, "This has to do with the seeds of social division and messages of contempt for democracy that come from the AfD and other right-wing extremists. In this regard, these people who have threatened to hunt us down, to clean up, and even to clear out this country, also share responsibility for the social climate in which these acts are possible." And these violent acts are sadly becoming more and more common in Germany. Attacks against politicians in Germany have doubled since 2019. I was actually really shocked to read quite how many politically motivated attacks there were each year. Mm. Last year, Green Party politicians were attacked the most. There were 1,219 attacks against them.
Jeez.
Politicians from the far-right AfD party were also attacked a lot, 478 times last year. Mm. And that is something that the AfD always point out in defence when they are accused of creating the culture that leads to violence, although I don't think it necessarily absolves them. The Social Democrats were also receiving a lot of political violence in Germany. There were about 420 attacks against them last year. And just to depress you a bit more, these attacks last Friday in Dresden weren't even the only attacks against politicians in Germany over the past week. Shall I give you a brief depressing rundown of the other attacks over the past week in Germany? Sorry.
It's very bleak, but yes, please.
Two Green Party politicians were attacked last Thursday in Essen. An AfD politician was punched in the face in Lower Saxony at the end of last week. And police arrested a man who was aggressively trying to get SPD campaigners at a stand in Magdeburg to leave.
This is really scary.
It is really scary. And I would feel threatened if I was campaigning in Germany right now. And the Green Party have actually started putting extra measures in place to try and protect their campaigners, understandably. They've told campaigners to stop going out to put posters up in two other cities in Saxony, Chemnitz and Zwickau, due to the uptick in political violence. The Greens also have a new policy to only appear at stands with a minimum of three members of staff to try and make it a bit safer. So I think it's understandable that these attacks are being described as a, quote, threat to democracy. That's the phrase that the Interior Minister of Germany, Nancy Faeser, also from the SPD, used when responding to the attacks of the past week. She's promised to respond with, quote, tough action and further protective measures for the democratic forces in our country. And it is definitely being taken seriously. As I think you mentioned, Katie, on the show before, the German Domestic Intelligence Agency say that far-right extremism is the biggest threat against democracy in Germany right now. Mm-hmm. They have already been increasing the security for politicians at campaign events and improving their security briefings. There's also legislation in Germany that forces social media companies to remove hate speech or receive hefty fines. And there are various initiatives from civil society trying to help educate young people about the importance of democratic systems. But I don't know exactly what more can be done in the immediate moment now, this run-up to the European elections. And yeah, I really hope that politicians are being protected and that people are able to campaign, because otherwise, indeed, democracy is being seriously threatened.
And while we're talking about those forthcoming elections, how are the AfD actually polling right now?
They've been in second place nationally for most of the past year. But the gap between them and the third place Social Democrats has been shrinking lately, with some more recent polls suggesting that the Social Democrats might actually beat the AfD to second place in the European elections. And I should probably also remind you who's in first place. That's currently the Christian Democratic Party of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. The AfD are, however, leading the polls in Saxony at the moment, where this attack took place. And there will be state elections in Saxony in September this year. Mm. But as with what you just told us in Georgia, there is a glimmer of good news in this horrible, horrible news, because there was a pretty incredible march in solidarity with Ecke in Dresden this weekend that popped up pretty spontaneously, attracting somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people who wanted to take to the streets to show support for him and make a stand against political violence. There was also a march in Berlin and a statement published by hundreds of politicians condemning the attack. So a glimmer of hope, but a bad week for democracy in Germany.
If you'll allow me to be disgustingly sentimental for a minute, one of the best things about my visit to Amsterdam last weekend was being able to meet so many of this podcast supporters and be reminded of what a lovely community we've built around this podcast over the past 6 years. Like, there were people there from all over Europe and other places in the world. And it left me with a very warm glow. I was also quite sunburnt. It was very hot. So maybe that contributed to the warm glow. But anyway, you guys are lovely. And we are incredibly grateful to all the people in Amsterdam and many, many other places who contribute to the running of this podcast every month with a little bit of spare cash.
Yes, thank you all so much. And thank you to our newest supporters, Lena, Erin, Philip, Alexander, Grace, Miruna, Sabina, John, Claudia, and also to Seraphim for increasing. Thank you all so much.
Seraphim was actually one of the listeners who came to the meetup, and I feel like he spent most of it witnessing a quite animated argument between you and me about Eurovision. So I'm surprised that he increased his donation rather than cancelling it. Thank you, Seraphim, and thank you, everyone else.
You can head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and find out what you can get in exchange for a few euros or pounds or dollars or whatever each month. We might even organise another meetup next time we're together in Brussels or Warsaw or London. Who knows?
Time for an interview. This week, we're talking about Nutri-Score, aka that little traffic light system that you possibly see on your food packets in the supermarket, which gives products a health rating from A to E, A being the healthiest, supposedly, and E being the worst for you, and in my view, probably the most delicious. I say that you possibly see these ratings on your food packets because Nutri-Score is only currently a thing in 8 European countries. It was launched here in France in 2017, and since then it's been taken up in Germany, Spain, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and, as of last month, Portugal. And that latest edition of A New Country has given us an excuse to finally talk on the podcast, Dominic, about this thing that you've been obsessed with for years now.
Also, it's becoming more and more topical because it's becoming quite like an important political issue on the campaign trail for the European parliamentary elections. Somewhat surprisingly, I think.
Yes, random.
Opposition to Nutri-Score has become a popular campaign point for some of Europe's Eurosceptic politicians. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, for example, actually cited the Nutri-Score as one of the many European things she is against when she launched her campaign for the European parliamentary elections a few weeks ago. And actually, just this week, her agriculture minister announced a possible change to the Italian constitution, which complicates any possible future adoption of the Nutri-Score in Italy.
I actually also saw those headlines, and at first I thought that the Italian constitution was specifically going to say something like, we as a country hate Nutri-Score or something like that. But I think it's going to be like a more conceptual reference to like protecting food products that symbolise Italy's national identity or something like that.
Gastro-nationalism is a big thing in Italy.
It really is.
I wanted to find out if any of the criticisms that Meloni and her pals have about Nutri-Score are actually founded in anything, or if they are just opportunistically enjoying having another reason to attack the EU. I guess both of those things, in theory, could be true. We'll find out in a bit, I hope.
Yeah. And one of the other things I was quite intrigued to find out about is whether Nutri-Score has made the countries that use it healthier than countries that don't. Actually, the more I think about it, the more I've realized, Dominic, you are right to be obsessed with Nutri-Score because I've realized I know basically nothing about how it works. So I was very happy that you found us the perfect person to explain the whole thing. Ali De Boer, Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Food Law at Maastricht University. We gave her a ring while I was actually in Amsterdam, so in the same place as Dominic, and we spoke to Ali from her beautiful office in the south of the Netherlands, in Venlo.
Hi, Ali.
Hi, Ali.
Hi.
Oh, I'm very close to you, Dominic.
You are.
We're sharing a microphone, everyone.
This is very strange. Sorry, I ate that kimchi sandwich, Katie. So, yeah, we're here to talk about the Nutri-Score today, something I'm a little bit weirdly obsessed with. And this strange fascination started a few months ago when I bought some chamomile tea and noticed it had a Nutri-Score rating of C.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was a bit confused. Yeah. I was wondering if we could start by looking at that. Do you have any idea why a product like chamomile tea could have such a middling Nutri-Score rating, despite it clearly, or I assume not really, being likely to be bad for my health?
Now, I don't think indeed chamomile tea will be indeed bad for your health. This brings us to one of the key difficulties, I think, of Nutri-Score. Nutri-Score is a very nice front of pack label that is based on a nutrient profile. So it's kind of an algorithm calculating the score that it actually gets on front of the package. But it is a calculation based on 100 milliliters or 100 grams of a product. And probably you don't drink 100 grams of that chamomile tea in your tea. Mm-hmm. So that makes it a bit confusing.
That would be a giant cup of tea.
Yeah, yeah, it would.
Huge tea bag.
But so that makes it already quite challenging to understand. The portion size is not taken into account. So it's a comparison based on 100 grams, 100 milliliters of a full product.
And is there actually like a person who decides how the calculation is decided? Is there someone who goes through from NutriScore doing it, or is it each producer that does it, puts it into a formula and works out exactly what rating they get?
No, there is this algorithm that's the same for everyone. It's based on actually a UK food scoring system, mm-hmm. but the algorithm has been slightly adapted based on novel insights into nutritional sciences to really come up with one verdict on the overall nutrient profile of a food product. So it combines the input of, for example, protein in a product, carbohydrates, fats. So it puts all that into one score. And it doesn't matter whether I do that, if I would be producing food A or you would be doing that producing food B. If we have the exact same recipe with the exact same ingredients, we end up with the exact same score. That's decided by a scientific committee.
And am I right in thinking that you can't really compare between different types of food products? So, for example, you can get Coke Zero or low sugar colas can get an A rating, whereas like olive oil could get a C rating. Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
What you see happening with these sodas that don't contain any sugar, they don't deliver any energy, that has a kind of favorable nutritional profile. Whereas olive oil, if you look at that, it of course has lots of fats in it because it's oil, but that is a negative aspect for a food product. So that makes it somewhat challenging because you use olive oil for the fat purposes as well. And again, you probably don't use 100 milliliters of olive oil, not in one dish at least. So even though the algorithm is the same for both type of products, you have to be careful in comparing. So it does allow you to discriminate between oils and fats that you use for the same purposes and between sodas that you use for the same purposes. But it wouldn't be fair indeed to compare potatoes with crisps. It wouldn't be fair to compare oils with sodas.
I mean, there is a really big divide in Europe about whether or not this food labeling system is generally a good idea. It's mainly only been taken up so far in the west of the continent.
Yeah.
And there are some critiques saying that it's biased against certain regional diets. For example, people often say that the Mediterranean diet is at a disadvantage because, as mentioned, olive oil has got such a bad rating. Uh-huh. Is it true that certain regional diets are more harshly treated by the NutriScore system?
Well, that's a very difficult question because on one hand, you would say definitely no, because it's just focusing on the nutritional content, right? There is no politics in that algorithm, so to say. So it's really looking at what is the nutritional density of a product and is that favorable or less favorable? But at the same time, the difficulty is in that we always get advice to consume, for example, olive oils over saturated fats and over butter, for example. But that's really difficult to be reflected very well in NutriScore. If you compare oils and fats with each other, you'll see that they mainly range from NutriScore C to E, for example. But of course, if you want to be promoting something, you would expect that it would have a NutriScore A. So that makes it quite difficult. So I would say it's not discriminatory, but at the same time, you can't see it as the only tool that you can go by to get nutritional and dietary advice, because you have to look at what is a healthy diet overall, what are healthy products to be consumed. And then NutriScore will help you to choose between two different types of products, for example, between the types of oils that you're thinking of, between the snacks that you were considering. So you have to use it for the right purpose in that sense.
So clearly it's not a perfect system and there's some nuance missing perhaps in it, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to understand, but is it still having positive effects? Like, is there any evidence to suggest that consumers in countries that have enforced the NutriScore are choosing healthier food?
Well, so far, actually, the main results that we've seen are from studies that have it's actually taking place in a supermarket where NutriScore was applied. And then you could see that people have, in the end, a healthier basket. So they did healthier groceries, in a sense. So Whether that makes a difference on the longer term, that's of course very difficult to say. But if we see these first results of these types of supermarket studies, we do see that there is some healthier decision making. That's one side of the effect. The other effect that you hope that such a label will have is that it might trigger food producers to reformulate their products, for example, to reduce the amount of salt in a product. And thereby, you actually make the product healthier for anyone who buys it. So yeah, we expect that there will be some effects, but indeed, it is not a miracle cure in the fight against obesity. We shouldn't expect that either. You said it perfectly. It's not a perfect system because a perfect food labeling system doesn't exist.
It came into force in the Netherlands, where I live and where you live, Ali, in January this year. But one thing I've been a bit confused about is the fact that it's not on all the food in the supermarket. Why is that?
Yeah, tricky thing indeed. Well, it's voluntary. So you can opt in with a specific brand. If I produce three different brands of foods, then I opt in with one, two, or three brands, and I don't get to pick and choose which of the foods within the brands opt in. If I sign up for Nutri-Score, I sign up with my full brand. But indeed, I have the opportunity to go for Nutri-Score. It's tricky because if I make a relatively healthy product, if I make a product with a relatively favorable nutritional profile, I'm probably more inclined to opt in for Nutri-Score. And if you make a product that has a less favorable nutritional profile, you might be inclined to not opt in. If we're standing in that supermarket, the comparison is again not fair.
Of course.
But at the same time, there's this thought process. If we talk, for example, with lawyers about this system being voluntary, they say, well, maybe officially it's voluntary, but it could very well be, if it gets picked up by a lot of food producers, it in practice becomes mandatory, because then you can't get away with not showing the Nutri-Score on your label. We have to wait and see what will happen there. But in the meantime, we're also still awaiting revisions of the regulation on food information to consumers that might tell us a little bit more about the ambitions of the commission to potentially make it mandatory, yes or no.
For now, it's just peer pressure.
Yeah, and consumer pressure maybe.
What I'm wondering if that peer pressure is going to work on, there are a couple of big food producing companies that have lobbied quite strongly against this. I'm thinking about Ferrero and Lactalis, an Italian and a French company, both of them giants in food production. Yep. And they are examples of the kind of companies that maybe don't have the best nutritional profile when you look at the range of products like Nutella, a favorite of mine.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of this lobbying provided a block on efforts to make Nutri-Score more widespread or even mandatory?
That's very difficult to estimate, because we know that there's lobbying going on, and we know that there's lobbying against Nutri-Score as such, but also against the whole idea of nutritional profiling systems in any case, and any kind of front of pack label that you could make from such a nutrient profile. But at the same time, it's not only industry. We also see that there's lobbying from different member states. For example, you already started saying, well, there are some Eastern and Southern European countries who think their regional products, their regional diets are negatively portrayed by the Nutri-Score. But we also see that from the Nordic countries, for example, they use the keyhole symbol. If you go to one of the Nordic countries, you can see on products that have a favorable nutritional profile, you will see a green keyhole label, and that's actually their front of pack labeling system. So it's not only the potential use of Nutri-Score, it's also, well, the difficulty in what front of pack label would be ideal in this situation in the EU and what could apply throughout the EU. That's being highly debated. So I think we can definitely agree on that there's some lobbying ongoing. Pro and con, by the way. Some food industrials are really in favor of putting Nutri-Score out there, but there's also the lobbying from the different member states. So it's very difficult to estimate what the effectiveness has been of specific food business operators.
Before we let you go, we wanted to ask you about another labeling system, because we know that you've done some research into the possibility of bringing in an EU-wide eco-labeling system for food. So a rating system on your food that would tell you how sustainable the production of the food is. On the one hand, sounds like a great idea. On the other hand, you might think, more information on the front of the packet. Like, I'm going to be even more confused about what I should buy. How likely is it that this kind of eco-labeling system will actually happen across the EU?
Well, I think we're very far from actually having one eco-labeling. There are some initiatives, actually, that look like Nutri-Score, for example, already. But it's very challenging because whereas with health and nutrition, we can actually say, okay, these are effects that we can see. With sustainability, we still are in debate about what kind of effect should we include in one label. Is it indeed only green? Is it also social justice? Is it animal welfare aspects, for example? Is it economic sustainability? So those types of questions we haven't even tackled yet. So for now, we definitely see different types of sustainability claims on products. And on one hand, I'm quite a fan of that transparency. So if I think it's important to reduce water intake, that I have the opportunity to see which products actually support that. At the same time, thinking about water, thinking about my CO2 footprint, combining everything at once might make things very, very difficult. So I can understand we seem to get a bit overloaded with information, and we need to, I think, do a bit more research to understand what is an optimal level of information and at the same time still support transparency as much as possible.
It was really fun doing an in-person interview with you, Dominic.
Despite my kimchi breath.
It wasn't so much the kimchi breath, but we were sharing a microphone, so we were sitting in very close proximity, and I did notice that your stomach was rumbling quite a lot during the interview. Did it make you hungry talking about Nutri-Score?
Jesus, Katie.
Is that too much info?
This is why this podcast works better at a distance.
Thank you so much to Ali for joining us. I still feel a little bit kind of on the fence about Nutri-Score, but I also feel like I understand it way better. So I feel better armed with specific things about it that could be improved. So thank you so much, Ali. If you speak Dutch, she made a great video about Nutri-Score, which I think is how you found her, actually, isn't it, Dominic?
Yes, it's a really good video. It's on a website called YouTube, and it's in Dutch, but it has English subtitles.
We will put a link to that in the show notes. Time to put into the inspiration station. What have you been enjoying this week?
I went to see Marina Abramović's exhibition at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. It's a retrospective of her artistic work over the past 5 decades. And if you don't know who she is, which, Katie, you said you kind of weren't really aware of her, right?
She knew the name, but I have to confess, sorry, I'm not a very cultured person, apparently. I hadn't really come across her work before.
No shame in that, but she is probably the world's most legendary living performance artist.
Okay, so a bit of shame in that.
Just a bit of shame. She is Serbian, born in Belgrade, then part of Yugoslavia, and she's 77 years old now. So she wasn't actually performing in the exhibition I saw herself, but there is a lot of amazing footage of her groundbreaking, sometimes terrifying performances. And there are also younger performers recreating some of her performances, including this piece, Imponderabilia, where the audience have to squeeze through a narrow doorway with 2 naked people standing on either side of it. So you can't help but brush past them. It's like quite an intimate, public, intense, strange experience, like a lot of her work, I guess. I was actually asked to audition for this performance.
You were going to be one of the naked people.
Well, I wasn't going to be because I didn't want to do it. But I'm on some list of people that are willing to do strange theatrical things in Amsterdam. So, yeah, I was asked for the audition. I'm glad I didn't have to do it because apparently the people who did it had to go away for a silent fasting retreat for like 7 days before they actually started.
Why? Why was that part of the process?
Well, if you went to this exhibition, you'd kind of understand because it's really an endurance test, I think, standing naked for hours on end with people brushing past you. So I guess it gets you into a zone. Anyway, I was quite in awe of the artistic output she presented in this exhibition, and it's really rekindled my fascination with her as an artist and as a person. I think this exhibition is going to be traveling around the world a bit more. It was already in London, But if it's not coming to a city near you, then I highly recommend you listen to the interview she had on the BBC last December on my favourite interview show of all time, Desert Island Discs.
Ah, great show.
She gives interviewer Lauren Laverne a bit of a hard time by insisting she doesn't want to reflect on any of her past works, but she does still share some amazing insight into her life and her work and her family. I'll post a link to that in the show notes too. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I've got something to recommend that would probably get a D or E rating on Nutri-Score. It's a cake recipe. We made a Googlehoof at home the other day. I say we made it. It's actually more accurate to say that my husband made it and I ate half of it. But it was extremely delicious, so I wanted to share it. Do you know what a Googlehoof is?
No, I don't. It sounds vaguely Germanic.
Yeah, so it's a traditional cake across a bunch of Central and Eastern Europe. Franz Josef, the Habsburg emperor, was apparently a big fan. The name of this cake varies from country to country, but it is essentially a ring-shaped cake made from a yeasty dough, so it rises very nicely. Usually it's got some kind of dried fruit in it. You can also make a marbly version with like chocolate dough and vanilla dough in a kind of swirly pattern. We made ours with raisins soaked in tea, which added some fun little nuggets of moistness, and it was delicious. So if you're having a bad week, this would be my suggestion. Make yourself a large ring-shaped cake. And maybe worry about the Nutri-Score implications later.
That's a great idea, but don't you need a special pan for it?
Buy yourself a ring-shaped pan, which then means that you are obliged to make lots and lots of ring-shaped cakes. This is what happened to us, and I do not regret it.
Okay, I might be willing to make that investment too. But before we go, Katie, I feel like I should mention that the big democratic event of the European year is also happening this week.
Yes.
The Eurovision Song Contest.
Okay, not the elections. Eurovision, of course.
Yeah, some people are boycotting it this year because of Israel's involvement. Many people are still going to be watching it, of course. Whether or not you are watching it, Katie says I'm not allowed to talk about it anymore on the show. Because
I didn't say that.
Two people said in our listener survey last year that we talked about Eurovision too much. So, yeah, just thought I should mention that I'm being censored by my co-host.
I didn't ban you from talking it. I gently suggested that maybe since we had so much Eurovision content on the show last year, we should do a bit of a correction to that and talk about it a little bit less. It's been mentioned like three times already this year anyway.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. There's been quite an abundance of happy ending stories floating around the internet these past few weeks. So many things I wanted to talk about, which is quite unusual, actually.
It is.
But the one that made me most happy in the past week or so is discovering that there is a European gull screeching competition.
Okay.
Human people come together in Brussels every year and compete to be the best at imitating gulls screeching.
Gulls being seabirds.
Yes. This phenomenon has set the internet alight, partly thanks to the charismatic 9-year-old British boy called Cooper, who won the junior category of the competition and actually got the highest points of all competitors, including the adults. I think we should hear a clip of his winning screech.
That's really good. I grew up next to the seaside and I can confirm that is an excellent and authentic screech.
He's also wearing a wonderful gull outfit, which makes this impression even more glorious.
How did he get into this? I have so many questions.
Apparently, the family found out about the competition because he was just like doing his gull impression at a soft play centre. And someone was like, you know, you're really good at that. There's a competition in Brussels. You should go.
What are the chances?
I know, it's so good. I love the story so much and I cannot get over the fact that this competition exists. I'm so happy for Cooper and his newfound fame. He's been like touring around British TV for the last few weeks. I will do anything I can to be there next year. I really hope they let members of the press and that we count as the press because I will be there.
Me too. Maybe competing. We will be back next week with more delicious chunks of European stuff. Does that sound tasty?
I thought you were against this like food analogy about our podcast. You told me it was disgusting at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, but I've since decided to get behind it. In the meantime, head to Instagram if you've got FOMO and want to see some pictures of us hanging out in real life in Amsterdam at Europeans Podcast. You can also find us under that handle or a very similar one on Twitter, Mastodon, Threads and Blue Sky.
This week's show was produced by a new producer. Thank you so much, Morgan Childs. And the interview was produced by Katie Lee.
See you next week, everyone.
Doei.
Nachrandis.